From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air.
Now this is a story all about how my life got flipped, turned upside down. And I'd like to take a minute, just sit right there. I'll tell you how I became the prince of a town called Bel Air.
I'm David Bean Cooley, filling in for Terry Gross. West Philadelphia, born and raised. On the playground is where he spent most of his days. On today's Fresh Air, the Fresh Prince himself, rapper and actor Will Smith. The first season of his Fish Out of the Ghetto TV sitcom, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, is just out on DVD. He also stars in the new film, Hitch. Also, Monty Python's Eric Idle. His Beatles parody mockumentary, The Ruddles 2, Can't Buy Me Lunch, comes out on DVD next month. He's also written the book for Broadway's King Arthur musical farce, Spamalot. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the new Japanese film, Nobody Knows. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
I pulled up to the house about 7 or 8 and I yelled to the cabbie, your home, smell your
lake. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Will Smith is a Hollywood power player, one of the few stars who can lure audiences in large numbers to his films, especially on opening weekend, and especially when he stars in summertime action blockbusters, like Independence Day and his two Men in Black films. He's also starred in less showy films, such as 6 Degrees of Separation, the biographical film Ali, and his latest film, the romantic comedy Hitch. But Smith got his start as a teenage rapper in Philadelphia, teaming up with DJ Jazzy Jeff and calling himself the Fresh Prince. Smith parlayed the success of his fun, non-threatening, and even self-deprecating rap recordings into a hit TV show. The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air lasted from 1990 to 96, and its first season has just been released on DVD. Long before Ryan left Chino for the OC, Smith played a sassy Philly kid who felt like a fish out of water after moving to California, an only slightly fictionalized version of Smith himself. Before we hear Terry's interview with Will Smith, let's listen to a clip from The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. His cousin Carlton, played by Alfonso Ribeiro, is rehearsing with his a cappella group when Will and his friend Jazz, played by his real-life recording partner DJ Jazzy Jeff, walk in.
She's a brick house. She's mighty, mighty, just letting it all hang out. She's a brick house. The lady's stacked, and that's a fact, and there isn't anything wrong with that.
Let's take 5, guys.
Will, was that really necessary?
Oh, I'm sorry, Carlton. You thought I was laughing at you?
It's what it sounded like.
Oh, no. See, when I laugh at you, it's more like this. Just for future reference.
Man, y'all butchered that song.
Hey, see, I'm telling you, if the Commodores heard you singing, they'd tie you down to the tracks and run you over with the Soul Train.
I understand why you're threatened. After all, you two possess absolutely no musical ability. Face it, you're so jealous you're green.
All right, but just out of curiosity, Carlton, what color are you?
Oh, here we go again. Look, just because I grew up in the best neighborhoods and pronounce the ING's at the end of my words doesn't make me any less black than you.
No, it's that tie that does it.
Look, faces, see, I'm telling you, if you went down to Jazz's neighborhood looking the way you look and talking the way you talk, you wouldn't come home walking the way you walk.
And what neighborhood is that?
Compton.
And if you can make it there, you'll make it anywhere.
A scene from the sitcom The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. The first season has just been released on DVD. Terry spoke with Will Smith in 2001. She asked him about his days growing up in Philadelphia and his early success as the Fresh Prince.
Your early raps were very funny, very self-deprecating. Mm-hmm. And this was a time in rap. I mean, I guess it's always been that time in rap where raps have been mostly about either bragging about how great your rhymes are, bragging about what a great lover you are, or bragging about how tough you are, or how many women you have, whatever. But your really breakthrough record, Parents Just Don't Understand, was about getting taken to the shopping mall by your mother who wants to buy you all these awful clothes that are going to ruin your credibility. Mm-hmm. In fact, why don't we hear a little bit of that?
You know, parents are the same no matter time, no place. They don't understand that us kids are going to make some mistakes. So to you other kids all across the land, there's no need to argue. Parents just don't understand. My mom took me school shopping. It was me, my brother, my pop, and my little sister all hopped in the car. We headed downtown to the Gallery Mall. My mom started bugging with the clothes she chose. I didn't say nothing at first. I just turned to my nose. She said, "What's wrong? This shirt costs $20. I said, "Mom, the shirt is plaid with a butterfly collar." The next half hour was the same old thing. My mother buying me clothes from 1963, and then she lost her mind and did the ultimate. I asked her for Adidas and she bought me Zips. I said, "Mom, what are you doing? You ruined my rep." She said, "You're only 16. You don't have a rep yet." I said, "Mom, let's
put these clothes back, please. She said, no, you go to school to learn, not for a fashion show.
That's the Fresh Prince, Will Smith. Will Smith, how did you end up taking that direction in your early rap records and going the self-deprecating route and admitting that you had a mother? I mean, most rap records don't admit they even have a mother. But,
well, you know, really, I was coming out of the early years of rap music, which were less about being tough and more about parties. So, I mean, it was still out. What I was doing was still sort of out of place. But I was younger making rap records than a lot of the people that were my peers in the rap world at that time. So I was basically an old school rapper with a new school crowd. So the style was based on there was a guy when I was coming up named Grandmaster Caz, and Grandmaster Caz used to make his party rhymes, but everything was always funny, and his rhymes always had a comedic edge to them. And essentially, I created my entire style after Grandmaster Caz. But I mean, he was as rare as I was. But the style is essentially based on being different. It's based upon doing something that will stand out and be as different as it could possibly be from all the other records that were being created at the time.
Now, did the persona on that record suit your real personality? I mean, was your mother really taking you to the gallery, the shopping mall in Philadelphia, and buying you the wrong sneakers?
Oh yeah, my mom, you know, she's really good at a lot of things, but the whole combination of clothes with the shoes, yeah, my mom wasn't like the best at that. You're good at it, Mom, now, but oh wow, you're in Philly, right? Yeah, so yeah. My mom's gonna be okay. Yeah, Mom, you weren't great at it, but you were good. But yes, it was tough some days, and it was even worse for my brother, because then after I was done with the stuff, he had to wear it old. At least I got to wear it new.
Well, how would you wear the wrong clothes to school? I mean, when you knew you were wearing clothes that you hated, mm-hmm. that other people, that your friends would hate too.
Yeah, that's
that would make you look foolish. Yeah, what do you do so that you can still not look foolish in spite of what you're wearing?
You just hope that somebody else has worse clothes than you, so you know, so then you can ride them. And I was always pretty funny, so the being funny was a pretty good defense, because even if someone had nicer clothes on me, I could make the crowd think that their clothes were worse than mine just by the jokes.
Like what? What would you say?
Oh God, anything. I remember when Haggar washable slacks came out. And that's, you know, if you called somebody's pants Haggar washable reversible slacks, you know, and you just, you know, you show them flipping them inside and out. They wear them one way on Monday and flip them inside out on Tuesday, you know, and if like, you know, you act that out physically, then you could generally make people laugh with that.
No, you weren't from a poor family. Your mother worked for the school board. Your father owned a refrigeration business. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that being, you know, did it feel like it would be more authentic if you did rap records if you were poor? You know, because sometimes authenticity in rap has been equated with being poor and being from a neighborhood where there's a lot of gangbanging.
Well, I mean, the neighborhood that I was from was, you know, working class neighborhood. I mean, it was we had our share of shootings and drug dealers. So, I mean, essentially, I am from the same type of neighborhood that those people are from. I just had, I took a different approach. You know, there wasn't, you know, it wasn't something that I embraced. You know, I avoided the drug dealers and avoided the dudes shooting craps on the corners and all of that. It just wasn't something that I I chose to embrace, but it was definitely something that was a part of my neighborhood.
You're really good with rhymes, and your recordings tend to tell interesting stories. I mean, they could almost mm-hmm. be a sketch. Mm-hmm. Did you ever write stories?
Yeah, when I was probably 12 years old, 13 years old, I used to write stories about my friends, and I would make them superheroes, and I would sell them. I would sell them their story, you know, Super Terry. You know,
what powers you want to give me?
Yeah, you know, that's what we would talk about, and we'd figure out what powers that you wanted to have and stuff like that. And then I would write a story where the kids were superheroes, and you know, sell them for, you know, 50 cents or a dollar or something like that. But I was doing that probably 12 years old to about 14 years old. I was doing that. My mother worked for the school board, and my grandmother was very much into education. So we were always writing and creating stories or reading Bible verses. We were always doing something literary.
Did you always have satisfied customers, or did your friends ever say, I didn't like the story, I want my 50 cents back?
Well, I would never. We didn't do refunds, but we would rewrite the story. You know, if you wanted a story adjustment, you know, I wasn't above a rewrite.
I guess that's good experience.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you can't get a cheese back.
So with your mother working for the school board, did she correct you a lot if you used improper grammar?
Oh yeah, we were
or slang
we were.
In your speech.
Yeah, we weren't allowed to use improper speech. You know, you would run out of the house. And say, yo, what's up? What y'all about to do? And mother say, up, back in here, back. We would get on punishment for words like y'all, and you know, you'd be in the house in the middle of the summer crying, and my grandmother would come up and say, baby, you know a y'all is a boat.
did that irritate you, or did you think, oh, I'm so glad that she's teaching me proper speech?
You know, yeah, it was, you know, that's, yeah, 12 years old. Oh, yeah, you know what? You're right, Grandma.
Right.
Proper speech. That's, no, it was tough. But that's something I've adapted in my life. I can't stop doing that to other people and to my kids. But, I mean, very, very early I remember that. I mean, it was just always important in my household to say things properly. I mean, in my neighborhood, kids would say, looked it. And my grandmother hated that, you know. You know, kids, oh, he looked it crazy. Oh, man. My grandmother hated that. And that was one that you'd almost get a 30-day punishment for that one. If you said something looked it like something, woo!
Do you feel bilingual?
Well, you mean bilingual in the sense of King's English and Ebonics?
Yeah.
Or English and Spanish?
No.
No. there's a certain bilingual element that all successful blacks have to have. You know, you have to be able to you know, speak to the head of IBM in a way that gives confidence and communicates a sense of your commitment to excellence and perfection, and it all starts with language. But at the same time, you got to be able to relax and chill with your friends.
Will Smith, speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to Terry's interview with actor Will Smith. She spoke with him in 2001 about his starring role in the film Ali. Here's an early scene in the movie. Muhammad Ali, then still going by the name Cassius Clay, is weighing in, preparing to fight Sonny Liston, and taunting Liston with his rhymes.
Sonny Liston, you jump. Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Ah! Rumble, young man, rumble. Y'all want to lose y'all money? Then you bet it on Sonny. He know I'm great. He will fall in eight. Come on, you big ugly bear. I'll whoop you right now.
Two ten and a half. The challenger, Cassius Clay, 210.5 pounds.
Man, you showed us right.
Oh, ugly bear, come on, let's go. You got all these folks fooled. I ain't scared of you.
218. Sonny Liston, the champion of the world. 218 pounds.
Pounds of what?
Pounds of ugly. That man's so ugly, when he sweat, the sweat run backwards off his forehead just to stay away from his face. Come on, you big ugly bear, I'll turn you into a rug.
So what did you have to do different to get Ali's voice when Ali was doing his rhymes or just, you know, doing his bragging thing?
Well, essentially, his voice, he has a really big, wide open chest, which gives you that really heavy resonance, but he constricts his throat, which gives you a really sort of higher pitch nasally sound. So I had dialect instructors that were teaching me how to technically where to place my tongue and how to hold my teeth and all of that in order to create the sound that Muhammad Ali created with his voice. So I mean, after a while, it became natural, but in the beginning, it was really constricted and really affected, and, you know, trying to stand up straight and trying to keep my chin down and all of those special little tricks that they taught me to create the sound.
Can you demonstrate what you did with your voice?
Can I demonstrate? Well, then I'd have to charge you my full fee.
Right. Well, fair enough. Were you much of a fighter?
Not really. I never was a good fighter, but I guess at about 12 or 13 years old, I was in school and I got into a fight in school with a guy named Jason Murphy, and he punched me square in the middle of my nose with all he had, and I realized that it only took a second for me to clear up. And while I was standing there realizing that it didn't really hurt that bad, he punched me again. And I was, it was a strange moment, but it was when I discovered that I could take a punch. And the second that I realized I was like comfortable getting hit, I became a better fighter tenfold. And I think that really helped me in this project, that not being scared to get hit is the center of what makes a fighter be able to be in a rugged war in the ring, because you already know that you're going to get hit. So your approach to that, you got to be in a position to get hit in order to hit somebody. That mindset of not running and not being scared is hugely important to be successful in the ring.
What has that actually, have you needed that? Have people ever tried to challenge you because you're famous and because you're self-deprecating in some of your rhymes? They figure, well, yeah, I can take him.
Well, a whole lot now that I played Ali.
Right.
So that, yeah, you know, now that's what Sylvester Stallone told me that too. You know, when I talked to him and I told him I was doing Ali, he said, oh man, he said, every movie theater and bar and mall in the country, everybody's going to want to fight you now.
Isn't that annoying? I mean, they don't feel like saying to the world, it's a movie.
Well, no, the thing is, if you drop one person real good and try to get hard copy or something to get it on tape, it'll be cool.
Right, right. Might as well make it pay. So did you have to actually take punches for the shoot?
Yeah, we decided very early on that there would be no movie fighting in this film, that all of the fighting was going to be real punches, real fighting. We would essentially do it like a stunt. You know, you set it up, you get five or six cameras going, and when we got in the ring, you know, we looked at each other, gave each other a pound, and went at it.
Now, when Ali got punched, he didn't know that this was going to happen a few minutes before, mm-hmm, it did. Whereas, you know, in this scene, you get hit hard. So does that help or no, not to know that it's coming?
Yeah, that's worse. That is much worse. That's what I told Ali. You know, I told him making this movie was way tougher than any of those fights that he had in real life. I said, you didn't know Joe Frazier was about to knock you down, but I knew James Toney was about to clip me good.
So what do you do to prepare for that?
You bite down on your mouthpiece really hard. Could be you don't want to have your mouth hanging open when you get hit. And, you know, you'd be surprised how, and it's a really weird feeling. I know it sounds bizarre, but there's something that's really cathartic about getting hit and standing up.
What was the worst punch you took?
It was the James Toney left hook, the one where Ali gets knocked down by Joe Frazier. Because essentially I just, you know, we had all agreed earlier that again, there's no movie fighting. So I went to James Toney before we did it and I said, listen, you know, this is for our families. This is for our children. This is for Ali's legacy. I said, so don't play with it. Go ahead, throw the punch in there. Let's get it good and let's go home. And he said, all right, man, I'll let it happen. I said, oh, and by the way, and then I just punched him in the nose right before the take. And he was like, okay. But that may not have been the best idea. It got because he laid into it pretty nicely on me.
Will Smith, speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. The first season of his TV series, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, is now out on DVD. And he's starring in the new romantic comedy, Hitch. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Raising the room, observe the high roller, mic controller, number one hip-hop son, call me Solar. Why? Cause I shine, praise the big Willie, I'm raised in Philly, I'm dazed in Philly, don't be silly, can't see me.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations. From Barnes & Noble, featuring the AARP Crash Course in Estate Planning. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. And from Bantam Paperbacks, publisher of Hallowed Bones, a mystery set in the Mississippi Delta by Carolyn Haynes, author of Crossed Bones. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Ouch, you're breaking my heart. Ouch, I'm falling apart. Ouch.
Coming up, Monty Python's Eric Idle. He promises that his show Spamalot is as good as, or quite likely better than, any other show with killer rabbits and a legless knight opening on Broadway this season. And David Edelstein reviews Nobody Knows. You've been listening to the Ruttles poking fun at the Beatles song Help with their version, Ouch.
Ouch, don't deserve me. Ouch, please don't hurt me. Ouch. They say it makes the world go round. I can't explain the way I feel for you. My feet don't touch the ground.
The way I feel for you, my feet don't touch the ground.
Ouch, don't deserve me. Ouch, please don't hurt me. Ouch, ow, ow, ouch.
When we first met, I must admit, I fell for you right from the start.
I must admit, I fell for you right from the start.
Now when we meet, all kinds of things, it seems, upset the apple cart.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Eric Idle is best known as a member of Monty Python's Flying Circus, the British comedy troupe whose bold, lunatic, irreverent, and very intelligent style influenced just about everyone and everything in the world of comedy, from Second City and Saturday Night Live to South Park. The Python impact is still going strong. A new musical called Spamalot, a stage version of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, is in previews on Broadway right now after a sold-out run in Chicago. It's directed by Mike Nichols and stars David Hyde Pierce, Tim Curry, and Hank Azaria. Idle wrote the book for the musical. He's also written a new hardcover book, Greedy Bastard Diary, published this month. In the late 70s, Idle was brilliant as a loving send-up of Paul McCartney in one of the best documentary satires ever made, The Ruttles, All You Need Is Cash. A sequel to that telemovie, The Ruddles 2, Can't Buy Me Lunch, will be released next month as a DVD original. Here's a clip from the 1975 film Monty Python and the Holy Grail, in which Eric and his fellow pythons are trying to decipher the meaning of a message carved in the wall of a cave.
There! Look! What does it say? What language is that? Brother Maynard, you're our scholar. It's Aramaic. Of course, Joseph of Arimathea.
Of course.
What does it say?
It reads, here may be found the last words of Joseph of Arimathea. He who is valiant and pure of spirit may find the Holy Grail in the castle of...
What?
The castle of...
What is that?
He must have died while carving it.
Oh, come on.
Well, that's what it says.
Look, if he was dying, he wouldn't bother to carve Arg. He'd just say it.
Well, that's what's carved in the rock.
Perhaps he was dictating.
Oh, shut up.
Well, does it say anything else?
No. Just
When Terry spoke with Eric Idle in 1999, he brought along his guitar, and she asked him to perform and explain the famous closing song from Monty Python and the Life of Brian. As the movie envisions it, Brian was a lesser-known contemporary of Jesus Christ's, who also ends up on a crucifix along with several other unfortunate prisoners. Brian tries to cheer them up by leading them in song, a song called Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. Eric Idle told Terry what they had in mind when they came up with the song.
Well, we had to face a complex problem of how to deal with all our characters. We're heading towards crucifixion, and there was no way of getting out of it. It was a common form of death for the Romans. It was like public hanging, you know. So we knew they were all going to have to die, and we couldn't face how could we deal with this image of the crucifixion. And we knew we were going to have a lot of people crucified because the Romans were fond of mass crucifixions. And so I said, well, let's do a song, you know, and it should be a cheery song. And so we thought the idea of people sort of singing a rather bright song as they being crucified, because they've got a couple of days, was a kind of wonderfully British sort of way of looking at things. And so I went off and I just came back and wrote this little quick little ditty, which has become an anthem in England for the many times we lose at sport.
And, of course, in the movie, your character's getting crucified as well, and you kind of kick off the song, and then all the guys getting crucified join in.
Yes. It's a rousing experience.
Would you sing it for us?
Sure. Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle, and this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. 'Cause life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your sin, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow. And always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath. For life's a precious gift when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And always look on the bright side of life. Come on. Always look on the
the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on that bright side of life.
That's a great song, and I love the way you do it. I love the whistling, that little, and that little trombone sound that you get at the end there. That's new, isn't it?
Well, I've always been able to do that. It's kind of a boarding school thing. When you're stuck at boarding school for 12 years, one of the things you learn to do are silly and pointless things that help to pass the time. So I can do, you know, I can do horn, French horn, and various things. I've used them on records, too. It's cheaper than musicians.
I think, you know, your most famous Python sketch is the nudge, nudge, wink, wink sketch. Two men meeting for the first time in a bar. Tell us about how you wrote it.
I wrote it for another show. I wrote it for Ronnie Barker, who was one of the two Ronnies. And I sent it in to some Frost show. And they sent it back unused because, of course, if you look at the script, it's incredibly boring. There are no jokes in it. It says, is your wife a goer? Know what I mean, know what I mean. Say no more, say no more. Nudge, nudge, know what I mean. Say no more, nudge, 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 nudge. It just comes straight back. And then I thought, well, that was rather funny. So I read it out at one of the really early Python meetings. Say, is your wife a goer? Eh? Know what I mean? Say no more, say no more. Know what I mean? Nudge, nudge, eh? Wink, wink, eh? Is she a goer? Eh? Does she go? Eh? And, of course, they fell about because it's kind of in the performance. And it's sometimes it's very hard to read comedy scripts. That's why Hollywood is so notoriously bad at reading comedy scripts, because it's often in just as the way you do it. I mean, I once picked up a Cleese sketch, a headmaster sketch, and I thought, there's nothing funny about this. And then I saw him do it, and he just reduced me to tears.
What kind of guy inspired this sketch?
The Nudge Boy is very much an English wide boy. He's, you know, he's down a pub. He's always down a pub, and he's, you know, he's a bit of a Jack the Lad. He rather fancies himself. But, of course, it's rather sad at the end. You know, he says, you know, you've slept with a lady. Yes. What's it like? So he's sort of kind of, he's that irritatingly nudgy person that really people don't behave like if they are well-behaved.
Well, let me play the Python sketch.
Your wife interested in photography, eh? Photographs, eh? He asked him knowingly.
Photography, eh?
Yeah. Snap, snap, grin, grin, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more.
Oh, holiday stamps.
Could be. Could be taken on holiday, could be. Swimming costumes, nudge, nudge. Candid. Candid photography.
No, I'm afraid we don't have a camera.
Oh. Still. Oh! Eh? Eh? Oh!
Look, are you trying to insinuate something?
No, 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 no. Yes.
Well?
Well, I mean, you're a man of the world, aren't you? I mean, you know, you've been around, you've been there.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, like, you've done it, with a lady. You've slept with a lady.
Yes.
What's it like?
So after the sketch, Eric Idle, did people come up to you for years and do the whole nudge, nudge, wink, wink thing?
That's still probably the most quoted to me, yes. And people love it so much, I just enjoy doing it. So in my stage show, I'm doing him a bit more.
Mm-hmm. Now your father died in World War II.
Yeah.
What were the circumstances of his death? He was killed on the way home?
Well, it's just kind of ironic. You know, he was in the RAF from 1941, and he was a rear gunner in a bomber, in bombers and things, and that's a very dangerous role. And then they were coming home on leave, and they said, well, don't use the railways, they'll be crowded, it's coming towards Christmas time, you guys should hitchhike, because everybody gave the forces rides when they're in uniform. So he got a ride, and he was in the back of a lorry, a truck, and a car swerved and cut in front of them, and they went off the road, and he was crushed, and he sort of died on Christmas Eve. So it was kind of bitterly ironic, you know.
I don't know how to say this exactly, but it kind of feeds the sense of tragic absurdity.
It certainly gives you a sense of irony. Of course, I was two and a bit, so I didn't really know why Christmases were so miserable and depressing. It really affected my mother. She never actually recovered from it. And she went into bleak depression. And part of my theory in the book is, and it's not just my theory, people I went into research a bit, is that comedians are formed by maternal abandonment and that they seek to replace some kind of parental love that they're not getting by being cute and funny and doing anything to entertain and solicit this love and this laughter from strangers.
And so that's your theory about why you became a comedian?
It probably accounts for why I did. I noticed on the playground with my daughter, who's 9, that when I go in there, I can tell which kids don't have mothers at home because they're being funny.
So you were sent to a boarding school that you've described as a semi-orphanage. In what way was it like an orphanage?
Well, it was an orphanage until the week before I got there, and it changed its name. It was the Royal Orphanage, and it became the Royal School. And what happened was I was sent there, and the RAF paid for my education, and they just took over this orphanage, and they sent all the kids who had lost fathers. So I grew up in, it's a very bizarre thing to do, I grew up with a whole group of kids who were stuck into this sort of horrible Victorian orphanage at 7, with none of them had a father, or most of them didn't have a father, so we had no sense of what fathers are or were.
Did you do plays and music and showbiz kind of things in boarding school?
No, absolutely. I used to have puppets, and we do puppet theatres and write and perform, and we were voices off. It's very much like what I do when performing. I'm very much more comfortable in makeup and with wigs and moustaches and beards. It took me a long time to become an actor who can just be just me or closer to my physical looks without some kind of disguise.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know when I was in public school in the States in grade school, one of the songs that we had to sing when we were in assembly was All Things Bright and Beautiful. And you wrote a very funny parody of that song. And I'm wondering if you had to sing All Things Bright and Beautiful when you were in boarding school?
Absolutely. And it always struck me as being wonderfully ironic. You know, it's like, well, what about all the other stuff in that was created? Was that not created by God too?
Can you sing us a little bit of All Things Dull and Ugly, your parody of All Things Bright and Beautiful?
I shall try. All things dull and ugly, all creatures short and squat. All things rude and nasty, the Lord God made the lot. Each nasty little hornet, each beastly little squid, who made the spiny urchin, who made the sharks, he did. All things dull and cancerous, all pox both great and small, putrid, foul, and gangrenous, the Lord God made them all. Amen.
That's very funny. Did you write that while you were in boarding school, or did you have to get much older and more sophisticated before writing that?
No, I was older and should have known better.
Eric Idle speaking to Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. And now for something completely similar. More of Terry's 1999 interview with Monty Python founder Eric Idle.
Now, what was the comedy that influenced you during your formative years?
As I grew up, radio was comedy king in England. We'd hear a lot of comedy on the radio. The Goon Show was very big. And then when television finally appeared, because I grew up without television until I was about 12, I loved Dick Van Dyke and I loved Bill Coe very much, and we get a lot of American comedy. But the thing that really changed my life was in 1962 I went to see a show in London called Beyond the Fringe, which had Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, Jonathan Miller and Alan Bennett, and it was the funniest single review I have ever seen. And I just rolled around and it changed my life. I learned all the words, and it suddenly made clear to me that all the authority I'd been suffering under was absolutely a load of nonsense, and my instincts to be subversive were absolutely right, and that these, you know, these people were funny and they were imposing their views of life on you. The military, the church, the teachers, all of this was actually mockable.
Did you ever play in a rock band or a folk band when you were a teenager?
I grew up playing the guitar. It was one of the great things was Elvis sort of gave us all great heart and hope and the Everly Brothers. And so when I was 14, Elvis came into my life. And then I had to have a guitar and we would play folk music. We'd play a lot of, Negro spirituals and things. And we identified very much with the black slaves of the south part of America. And we'd sing all these,
Let my people
songs
go.
About Jim Crow. Exactly. We were totally identified with that. It was very interesting. And then, I played a bit of harmonica and guitar. And then eventually, when the Beatles came through, everybody tried to play pop music. And that's when I got into that.
Let me ask you, if you would, to play a few bars of a song from the old days, a song you used to do as a teenager.
What would you do? If you're white, you're all right. And if you're brown, stick around. But if you're black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back.
Good. So were you doing that at like folk clubs and things?
Well, at school. No, we didn't go out to folk clubs.
That's right, right.
Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee were huge. I love them. They're uh-huh. so great.
Uh-huh.
Big Broomsey, all those sort of folky things.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, you went to school in Cambridge, got into the performing group Footlights, mm-hmm. where you met some of the other Pythons. You became the president of Footlights, and I read that the first thing you did was to initiate a bill allowing women to join this theater club. What inspired you to open it up to women?
Well, I mean, it was fairly absurd. This club had been going since 1883, and they didn't allow women, into the club. It was absurd. So being a kind of radical kind of 60s thing, I said, no, we absolutely have to admit women. We want to have funny women. We need them for the show as well as anything else. And so a lot of gay dons wept and beseeched me not to change anything. They love these. They're all called Binky and love little men dressed up as ladies and pretty boys singing frightfully witty lyrics. And I said, no, it's absolutely not. This is the 20th century. We have to. And the first woman to join who came through the door, which you could believe it or not, was Germaine Greer.
Oh, no. That's funny.
And she was...
I wouldn't think of her as excelling in comedy, but...
She was tremendous fun. I loved Germaine.
Now, the funny thing is that you opened up the doors of Footlights to women, but, of course, the Pythons had no women in the group. Why didn't you want women in the group?
Well, it's not a question of why didn't we want them. There wasn't a woman that we knew who was from the background that we were drawing our pool of chaps from. I mean, it's a conflation of two shows, Python. There was a kid's show called Do Not Adjust Your Set, and there was a show called Not the 1948 Show. At last, it's the 1948 Show. And, if there had been a great writer, performer, woman, she could easily have been in it. But there wasn't. She wasn't around. This person wasn't there. And it was certainly easier. It was just easier for us. And that's the way it was. I mean, why were there no women in the Beatles? It's one of those questions,
on asking Paul McCartney that sometime soon. So of course, this left the Pythons to play the women's parts themselves. What kind of woman do you think of yourself as having specialized in?
Well, I used to play one version or other of my aunts, where there were four aunts, and they were all in various qualities of class structure. And I used to play very much the upper-middle-class aunt, type of aunt, because I like those. And also, you don't have to alter your voice terribly much to be in their sort of register and timbre, And I like that sort of very English, rather correct lady who's very, very well-mannered and polite, but rather firm.
Eric Idle, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Would you close with a song for us?
I'd like to close with a song which is my favourite song, my wife's favourite song, and it's a song that Clint Black has just recorded on his new album, and I wrote him a new intro for it, and it's called The Galaxy Song. Whenever life gets you down and things seem sad and bad, just remember that you're travelling on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. That's orbiting at 19 miles a second, so it's reckoned the sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see
are moving at a million miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of the galaxy we call the Milky Way. Our galaxy itself contains 100 million stars. It's 100,000 light years side to side. It bulges in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us it's just 3,000 light years wide. We're 40,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years. And our galaxy is only one of millions and billions in this amazing and expanding universe. The universe itself keeps on expanding and expanding in all of the directions it can whiz. As fast as it can go, at the speed of light you know, 12 million miles a minute, and that's the fastest speed there is. So remember when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely is your birth. And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere out in space, 'cause there's bugger all down here on Earth.
Eric Idle speaking and singing with Terry Gross in 1999. He's written the book for the new musical Spamalot, now in previews on Broadway. It stars David Hyde Pierce and Tim Curry and is based on the movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Coming up, David Edelstein on the new Japanese film Nobody Knows. This is Fresh Air. The Japanese film Nobody Knows is inspired by the true story of four children in the late 80s, left by their mother to fend for themselves in a small apartment. There was a national uproar after tragedy struck and the truth came out. But the film approaches that story from a less sensational vantage point. David Edelstein has this review.
It opens with a train ride, a boy and his mother. She's awfully cute, even a little babyish. The boy looks older than she does. He's solemn and preoccupied. He sits next to a big yellow suitcase, which he gently caresses. When he and his mother arrive at their new apartment building, they lug that suitcase and another up the stairs. And when they get to their apartment, they open it up and a little girl rolls out, smiling, happy, clutching a doll. There's a boy in the other case. The landlord mustn't know there's more than one child, and there are four in all, the youngest boy mentally disabled. So the three younger kids may never go out, not even onto the veranda, to do laundry. Hirokazu Koreeda's Nobody Knows is based on what was dubbed in Japan the affair of the four abandoned children of Nishisugamo. Four children of different fathers took care of themselves and one another for long periods while their mother went off with assorted men. The older boy, here called Akira, did the shopping and occasionally sought out one of his siblings' fathers for money. But none of them had ever gone to school, and none knew how to keep house, treat illness or injury, or function as a parent. The film has been compared to the great Italian neorealist tragedies of the 40s and 50s, but it's more austere and more elusive. All the same, the director's humanism is in every frame. Koreeda has said he wanted to make you see this frightening and unfathomable story in a compassionate light, and to show the profound communion among these four children, who learn to support and sustain one another in the absence of parents. So whatever the children do together has a magical clarity, a fullness that stops your breath, playing the game rock, paper, scissors, plinking a toy piano, running up and down a long stone staircase. Even after the mother has been absent for 6 months and the fragile bonds are beginning to dissolve, there's a shot of the overdue gas bill with lovely childish doodles all over it, so blessedly oblivious to the reality that is fast encroaching on this dream life. That reality does come, and it must be said that watching four kids slowly starve from neglect over the course of a year is almost impossible to bear. As the children gaze out at the world through windows or fences, sometimes at other kids, school kids, sometimes at trains heading for the airport in points unknown, you're reminded that even the worst parent in the world is essential not only for children's survival, but their sense of self. These children have no way of making sense of what they're going through, or of a world that doesn't register their existence. They don't even know enough to be angry. The performances of the children, especially Yuya Yagira as Akira, are beyond praise. You never even register that they're actors. And the director doesn't demonize the mother, played by a Japanese pop singer known as Yu, who seems less like a monster than a narcissistic child in her own peculiar world. Nobody Knows gives you no conventional release. The director ends the movie before the world discovered the abandoned children of Nishi Sugamo. I found the last sequence so wrenching I could hardly look at the screen. Yet I think Koreeda means it to be hopeful. In an indifferent universe, these precious moments of love, grief, and human interaction are the tenderest mercy.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Ian Chillog directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From TIAA CREF, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good, TIAA-CREF.org. And from the Alzheimer's Association, encouraging Americans to stay active, eat right, and make brain health a personal and national priority at alz.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, clarinetist, composer, bandleader Don Byron. He's got a new CD saluting saxophonist Lester Young. Join us for the next Fresh Air.